All right, welcome again to our next study in this year's Bible Bee in the book of Jonah. We're in the midst of a study through chapter 1. We just began chapter 1 last week with verses 1 through 3. Of course, we covered the concept of Jonah as a prophet of the Lord calling Jonah, giving him a unique and special assignment to be the first of the, in a sense, kind of a missionary prophet to a Gentile nation, calling him to arise from his location in northern Israel and travel 600 miles across country to go to the nation of Assyria and the great capital city of Assyria, which was the city of Nineveh, and to proclaim the Lord's warning word of judgment to that city. Jonah was not thrilled about his assignment, didn't like it at all, and so he forms a plan. His plan is to go exactly the opposite direction. Instead of going north and east toward Assyria, he got up and he traveled south and west. And he goes down to the port city of Joppa, and he finds a ship there which is sailing to a far distant land called Tarshish, which was most likely modern-day Spain, the farthest end of the Mediterranean Sea. So that Jonah, in a sense, is traveling as far away from his assignment as he can possibly get. Now, there's one last detail in verse 3 that I mentioned last time, and we ran out of time to fully or adequately cover it, so I want to pick up at the end of verse 3, and then we'll continue through our study today, starting in verse 4 and moving through to verse 10. So I'm going to reread verse 3. And I'm going to read through to verse 10, and that's all we'll cover for today's study. So Jonah 1, verse 3. But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God, and they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation, and where do you come from? What is your country, and of what people are you?" He said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this that you have done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. All right, the last detail I want to focus on at the beginning of our study this time that we didn't fully cover is this repeating phrase. I mentioned it last time, but this repeating phrase in verse 3, where it says, Jonah rose to flee from the presence of the Lord, and then at the end of verse 3, as he gets on the ship to sail to Tarshish, he did so with this intention to go away from the presence of the Lord. This is an important concept in the book. It's a very important principle that runs throughout God's Word, and it displays in the way this story is told that Jonah had a flaw in his understanding of exactly who the Lord was. Now, we know that Jonah knows the Lord. We know that Jonah has a relationship with the Lord. We know that Jonah has a special calling from the Lord, that the Lord's hand is upon Jonah, that Jonah is a true prophet of God. And if there's anybody at this moment in history, on the face of the entire earth, that knows the Lord and knows what the Lord is like, we are right to expect that it would be Jonah. But just because Jonah knows the Lord, just because he's a prophet, doesn't mean that he has a perfect understanding of who the Lord is and what the Lord is like. There are many times in the accounts of different men and women of God that we find in the Bible that we discover that as they're walking with the Lord, they're gaining new understanding and wisdom about who the Lord is and what he's like. In their growing relationship with the Lord, their hearts are growing in their understanding of just how great the Lord actually is, learning new things about his attributes, his qualities, the unique characteristics that make him God. And so what we see here in Jonah is that he has a true knowledge of God, but it is an incomplete or an imperfect knowledge of God. And it's not just here at the beginning of the book. This is a theme that's going to run throughout the entire book of Jonah. The book opens with a hint here in verse 3 about the lack of Jonah's right understanding of the Lord. And it continues all the way through to the end of chapter 4 when we discover that there are still things at the end of the story that Jonah is learning about the Lord. The thing that's revealed here at the beginning that Jonah doesn't fully understand is the concept or the principle of the presence of the Lord. Now, what is meant here when this phrase is used twice, the presence of the Lord? We are not talking about the physical presence of the Lord. The physical presence of the Lord, for instance, would be on display in the account of the four Gospels in the New Testament, where Jesus, who was the Lord, was born as a human being and physically was present with his disciples during the time of his life in this world. We're not talking about that kind of presence, because the Lord was not physically present with Jonah before the book starts. So when it says that he was attempting to flee from the presence of the Lord, we're talking about his understanding of what we would call the spiritual presence of the Lord, not the physical presence of the Lord. And so Jonah, being located in the promised land, the land of God's special concern during this period of history, has decided, after the Lord tells him to go and accomplish this mission, he doesn't want to do that, and so he runs the opposite direction. And his intention in going to Joppa and beyond Joppa to Tarshish is he wants to escape, to run away from the spiritual presence of the Lord. Now, there's good reason why Jonah thought that he could accomplish that. Jonah's not an ignorant man. As I said, he knows the Lord. He knows a lot about the Lord. He knows more about the Lord than all of the other people that he's going to be interacting with later in the book, and even in our study today. But he doesn't yet know everything about the Lord. But what he does know is based in Scripture. Let's keep our place in Jonah. Let's turn all the way back to the beginning of Genesis chapter 4. Most of you, I hope, are familiar with one of the early stories in the book of Genesis, the story of the first two brothers in human history. Who are the first two brothers in human history?
Cain and Abel.
Cain and Abel. And that story of their relationship didn't end well. Cain rose up in his jealousy and he murders his brother Abel. And what we're going to read is what happens after that as the Lord deals with Cain in his sin. We're going to read from Genesis chapter 16, verse 15. Genesis chapter 4, verse 15. Then the Lord said to him, this is the Lord now speaking to Cain, "Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went where? Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now, Jonah knew the story of Cain and Abel, just like every other godly man in Israel in those days would be well familiar with this story, and most especially a prophet of God would be most familiar with this story. Cain, after his sin, and after the Lord confronts him in his sin, Cain leaves his present location, and where he was located was somewhere near the Garden of Eden. Remember, Cain and Abel's parents, Adam and Eve, had been driven out of the Garden of Eden, but they stayed somewhere near the Garden of Eden after being driven out from the garden. And now Cain leaves that area, and he goes to a different land, the land of Nod, which is somewhere east of Eden. But when he leaves, this is what he's doing in his own heart and mind. This description is describing how Cain experienced leaving this one location where his parents were and going out and striking out into new territory. It says he went away from the presence of the Lord. So there is a sense, and the Bible describes it for us, in which you can actually go from one location to another location and leave, and going to the new location, the presence of the Lord. And we're talking not about this physical presence, we're talking about his spiritual presence. All right, so what sense is that? Well, the Bible describes the presence of the Lord in two ways. And sometimes believers get confused about the distinction between these two ways, but it's important for you to understand there's two ways that the Lord talks to us or speaks to us in his word about his own presence. And I'm going to give you categories, I'm going to give you titles for these two ways that the Bible describes the presence of the Lord so that you can understand what's going on with Jonah in this circumstance. First, what we're talking about is what I'm going to call the revealed presence of the Lord. Sometimes Bible scholars also refer to this as the manifest presence of the Lord. But I'm calling it the revealed presence of the Lord. So turn with me now to another passage in the book of Exodus as an example. This is from Exodus chapter 33. And this is an account of an interaction between the Lord and the greatest prophet in Old Testament history, greater than Jonah. This is the prophet Moses, of course, the first and great prophet, the prophet that the Lord called to reveal his law to his people. And this is an interaction between Moses and the Lord in which Moses is concerned because of the sin of the people of God as they've rejected the law of God that's just been brought to them. And now Moses is interacting with the Lord and, in a sense, interceding, praying to the Lord on behalf of the people. We're going to read from Exodus 33, and we'll read starting in verse 9. This is a meeting between the Lord and Moses at what was called the Tent of Meeting. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. What was this pillar of cloud? Yes. It did look like smoke. It looked like a cloud. But this is the pillar that led the children of Israel, remember, out of Egypt, led them across through the Red Sea as the waters were divided, led them into the wilderness, and led them for all 40 years of their journey in the wilderness. They followed this pillar of cloud by day, and it was the appearance of it was a pillar of fire at night to light their camp. And this pillar represented the presence of the Lord in the midst of his people. All right, so the Lord would descend when Moses would enter the tent and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak to Moses the implication here is that the Lord is speaking out from the pillar of cloud to Moses. And it goes on to say, and the people would rise up and worship each at his tent door. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me, yet you have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people." Now, this is the Lord speaking. Verse 14. And he said, "My presence," this is the key concept that we're focused on in Jonah, "my presence will go with you." Now, in this sense, that means the presence of the Lord is localized in one spot on the face of planet Earth at any one given moment in time. The presence of the Lord is actually moving here from one location to another location. All right? "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Now, this is Moses answering the Lord, verse 15. And he said to him, Moses said to the Lord, "If your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here, for how shall it be known that I found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us that so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?" So, in this passage, and this isn't the only passage that teaches this principle, what we see is what I'm calling the revealed presence of the Lord. This is a localized presence of the Lord, where the Lord makes himself known, reveals his presence to his people in one location, and that presence can move from location to location. And if that presence is in only one location, then you can leave that location, go somewhere else, and in doing so, you're leaving, in a certain sense, the presence of the Lord. It's in that sense that Jonah thought that he could get on a ship in Joppa, sail to Tarshish, and escape and get away from the presence of the Lord. He's escaping from or running from the revealed presence of the Lord, which was focused in the promised land at that moment in history during the time of Jonah. But the Bible speaks about another sense of the Lord's presence, one that Jonah did not fully understand at this point in his spiritual growth. And it's this second sense that the Lord is now going to be teaching Jonah in the circumstances that are immediately ahead of him. Let's turn to the book of Psalms. And this is probably the most famous passage. This is Psalm 139. Probably the most famous passage in the Bible that describes this principle of the second way that God reveals his presence. And the second way is what we call in theology omnipresence. The omnipresence of the Lord. O-M-N-I. Omnipresence. And the word omni simply means everywhere. So in one sense, the revealed presence of the Lord, he is present only in certain locations at certain times. But in another sense, the Lord is also at all times omnipresent, meaning he is present everywhere. This is what is described in Psalm 139. We're going to read just the first few verses of the psalm. This is a psalm of David. David wrote this psalm before the days of Jonah. Jonah had access to read this psalm, but apparently he had not been paying close enough attention to Psalm 139, as he should have been. This is what David writes by the Spirit of God. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. That's implying that the Lord knows what we're going to say even before we say it. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? There's our key word. Shall I flee to Tarshish? Will that be far enough away to get away from the presence of the Lord? Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, what is Sheol? The Sheol in the Old Testament is the place where the souls of men go after death. Meaning spiritually even. Beyond just the furthest place physically. If I go to the furthest two locations, heaven above or Sheol beneath, if I go to either of those locations, what does David say? If I make my bed in Sheol, you are where? You are there. The Lord is there in heaven, and the Lord is there in Sheol. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, and that's, by the way, what Tarshish represented to Jonah. Tarshish was at the uttermost end of the sea. That Joppa was at the beginning of that journey, but Tarshish was at the uttermost parts. Verse 10, even there your hand shall lead me and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. All right, this is a psalm, this first several verses of the psalm. It's a psalm about the omnipresence of the Lord. And David's speaking to God's people by the Spirit of God about how the Lord cannot be escaped in the ultimate sense. You can't flee from the presence of the Lord in the ultimate sense, because the presence of the Lord is everywhere on the face of planet Earth all at the same time. So there's these two senses of the Lord's presence. He can reveal his presence in one spot, one location at a time, and that's all Jonah was really thinking of. But he's also present everywhere, and there's no escaping from his presence. All right, so that brings us up to verse 4. Jonah has gone down to Joppa. He's found a ship that's heading for Tarshish. He pays the fare. He gets on board the ship, and he's trying to escape from the presence of the Lord. Verse 4 starts with an important small little word, but. The Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea. Okay, what this represents is Jonah's got a plan. And in his mind, the plan's going to work. If I just get away as far as I can get from the promised land, I will escape the presence of the Lord. And what the Lord does is he allows Jonah's plan to go into action up to a certain point. Remember, I told you Joppa was not part of the promised land. So the Lord allows Jonah to get up and leave his hometown in northern Israel to walk all the way down to Joppa. And so far as he's walking to Joppa, the plan's working. And he gets to Joppa, and he finds perfect a ship going all the way to Tarshish. And they've got room for me, and I've got just enough money in my pocket to pay the fare for the ship. And he gets on the ship, and the ship leaves port, and the ship is now sailing for Tarshish on nice, calm seas. The plan is working perfectly. And the Lord has allowed Jonah to think that his plan is working perfectly. And then the Lord interrupts Jonah's plan. So when you're pursuing a direction in your life that you've planned out and you've worked out all the details, but it doesn't represent the Lord's plan for your life, you can anticipate that you will experience something like what Jonah experienced. Now, no one here in this room will ever be swallowed alive by a giant fish. So we'll never experience exactly what Jonah experiences later in this chapter. But we will experience this, and every single believer will experience this in the course of their walk with the Lord. When your plans are not in agreement with the Lord's plans, the Lord will, just like he does for Jonah here, interrupt your plans. And the Lord interrupts Jonah's perfect plan that's working perfectly all the way until the ship leaves Joppa. But when the Lord interrupts him, this is not how he does it. He doesn't show up on the ship. The Lord doesn't tap Jonah on the shoulder and say to Jonah, "Excuse me, would it be okay with you if I interrupt your plans? Can we talk about your plan to go to Tarshish? Can I convince you not to go to Tarshish? Would you please consider not going to Tarshish?" The Lord does not interrupt Jonah that way. How does he interrupt him? He interrupts him in what we might consider, if we were in Jonah's sandals, we might consider it somewhat of a rude interruption. Though the Lord is not really being rude, he is being abrupt in the way that he interrupts Jonah's plans. And he interrupts him in a way that Jonah can't stop it. Jonah can't resist it. Jonah can't keep it from happening. He interrupts Jonah by, it says, hurling, the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea. And the description here, great wind, we're talking about that the weathermen nowadays have different terms to describe this, but I'm going to describe it as what they would call hurricane force winds. Have you ever been outdoors on a really, really, really windy day? Here in Chatsworth, sometimes we get particularly windy days. You might have the wind blowing as high as 40 to 60 miles an hour on a really super heavy wind day. And if you've got a wind like that, you know it can really, really affect you. But hurricane force winds blow much stronger, much faster than the hardest wind you've ever experienced here in Chatsworth. Hurricane force winds go over 100 miles an hour, and in some cases can blow up to 200 miles an hour. The Lord hurled what is described here as a great wind. It's interesting the term that's used to describe how this wind came up. The wind did not happen accidentally. It wasn't a coincidence. This was not a natural wind that just happened to start blowing. This was a supernatural wind. And what I mean by that is, the wind itself wasn't spiritual. It was real wind in this real world, but the reason why it started blowing at that moment in time and in that specific location is that there was a supernatural or spiritual cause to the wind blowing, and that was the power of the Lord himself. I mentioned in our introductory study that we would be seeing different elements of the Lord's sovereignty on display in the book of Jonah. The concept of sovereignty just simply means that the Lord is in charge of everything, including what we call nature. All the elements of this world in which we live, land, sea, air, fire, all water, all of the elements of this world in which we live are 100% under the Lord's authority and power at all times. So the Lord hurled a wind. The word for hurled here is used elsewhere in the Old Testament to describe soldiers in battle when they take a javelin and hurl it at their enemy, targeting their enemy. And that's the specific word that's used here to describe the Lord causing this wind to blow against the ocean and against the ship that Jonah was sailing on. The implication is, at this moment in time, Jonah didn't start out this way, but this is where he was at this moment. Jonah was acting like an enemy of the Lord. And the Lord was in battle with Jonah. The battle was a test of wills. Whose will is going to be done? Is it going to be Jonah getting his way? Or is it going to be the Lord getting his way? And that's a fight. That's a test of strength. Who's stronger, Jonah or the Lord, in this circumstance? And so the Lord targets Jonah. Jonah thinks he's escaping, but the Lord's got a laser-guided target right on Jonah's chest. And the Lord hurls a wind, just like a soldier hurling a javelin, directly at his target. And the Lord, unlike soldiers, never misses his target. So the wind blows, and the result is there was a mighty tempest on the sea. This is what we call a hurricane. It's called by different terms, different places in the world, but in our culture, this is what we call it. It was a giant storm at sea, tremendous storm at sea. And it was so severe that the ship threatened to break. Meaning that not running on the rocks, you know how ships are in danger if they run aground against rocks, they can break up. There were no rocks out where they were. This is right out in the middle of the ocean. But you need to catch how severe this storm was. The wind and the waves were so severe that just the force of the wind and the waves was tearing the ship apart. Now, the result of this, of course, is in verses 5 and 6, how it affects, we're told first, Jonah's shipmates. Then the mariners were afraid. This is not a baseball team in Seattle. This is the men who worked on the ship. Mariners were professional seamen. These guys went to sea for a living. They were used to being on the ocean. They were used to storms. The Mediterranean is well known for sudden storms. And they've been through this kind of thing before, but there's something about this storm that unnerves them. The mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. The idea of crying out here is, this is how afraid they were. They thought they were about to die. They thought they were about to die. They didn't want to die. They weren't ready to die. They're crying out to their gods in hopes that they won't die from this storm. But they know it's useless to do anything other than pray at this moment because the storm is so big, so strong, that they're not going to be able to sail safely through the storm. Now, what's interesting about their crying out here is that this tells us that these mariners were religious men. You can tell what a man really believes down deep in his heart when he is convinced that he's about to die. These men were convinced they were about to die. And so we find out at those what we call moments of crisis, life-threatening moments. I was in a truck accident years ago. I used to do deliveries in a truck, a large truck, and I had another man in the truck working with me. We were a team delivering for this particular day, and we came over the crest of the hill, going downhill suddenly. And the brakes on the truck went out. And it was a heavy truck, and it started moving really fast. And in a moment's time, I realized I could die in this circumstance. Now, I was a Christian at this moment. I had a relationship with the Lord. I knew the Lord. I'd been born again a few years before this. And when the moment occurred where I realized we can't control the truck, we can't stop the truck from crashing, that's the moment where whatever's in my heart is going to come squeezing out. And the person that was with me later, because we both did survive, I'm here to tell the tale, the person that was with me, I asked him later about his experience that day in the truck, and he said the only thing that he was aware of is he could hear me yelling at the top of my lungs, loud. And what I was yelling was, "Jesus, help us!" And it stuck with him. He remembered it. Because that was what was in my heart. That was squeezed out of me in that moment where my life was at stake. He did not know the Lord. And all he was doing, he was driving, he was clinging to the steering wheel, shaking in his boots, scared out of his wits, not knowing what to do. And he wasn't a religious man. He didn't cry out to any God because he didn't believe in any God. But the Lord spoke to him through me in that circumstance. Now these men think their life is about to come to an end. And they cry out. And it's revealed that they're religious men. But they're crying out, each to his God. And in our translation, God is in a small case G here, which just lets us know. They're not crying out to the Lord of heaven and earth. They're not crying out to the one true God. They're not crying out to Jonah's Lord and God. They're crying out to the false gods of the land and the people from which each of them came. What we have here is kind of an international crew on this ship, each from a different location, each from a different tribe, each from a different country, each worshiping a different false god. But because they believed in their gods, that's who they cried out to in this moment of crisis. The problem is, their prayers were completely useless. Why? Prayer is good always, isn't it? Prayer is powerful, isn't it? Always? No, prayer is not always good and it's not always powerful. It depends on who you're praying to. And it depends on how you're praying. So these men were doing the activity of prayer in the moment of crisis, but their prayers weren't going to help them one bit because their prayers weren't actually going to any true and living God. Their prayers were heading for the fantasies of the false gods that they believed in, which did not actually even exist. So they were just wasting their breath, even though they didn't realize it in this moment of crisis. So they cry out to their gods, but their gods aren't listening. Their gods aren't answering, and the storm is not stopping. And they are going to lose their lives unless something happens in this circumstance. So what do? First they pray, and that's the best thing to do, is to at least try to pray. But there's no answer coming, so now they get real practical. And they do the one thing they can do, which is they throw all the cargo on the ship overboard. Cargo tells us that this was a merchant ship, meaning they were transporting valuable goods from Joppa to Tarshish. They were doing business between these two port cities. The cargo they threw overboard represented dollars. Real money. And it's how the men would get paid at the end of their voyage. And what we see here is that men go to work for a reason. Men go to work in order to earn money. And that's right. And there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. And these men were working on this ship in order to earn the money. But when their life was on the line, what was more important to them? The cargo or their lives? It's not the cargo. You can always get more cargo. You can't get more life. Once your life comes to an end, that's the end. So these men threw the cargo overboard, willing to let go of the money they would earn from this voyage in hope that they could just survive the voyage. Just get to the next harbor safe and alive. Now, they throw the cargo overboard to lighten the ship because in a storm, water comes into the ship from the waves and the rains, and it weighs the ship down, and that leads to the ship being unbalanced and potentially sinking in this circumstance. So they're hoping for the ship to be lightened and to be able to survive the storm. Now, that's what the mariners, that's what the shipmates of Jonah are doing in this crisis. Keep in mind, how heavy is the wind? How big are the waves? How big is the storm? The storm is so big that it's literally tearing the ship apart and causing experienced seamen to be afraid for their lives. And they're doing everything they can do. They're throwing the cargo overboard. And how is Jonah reacting in this crisis? Well, let's talk about Jonah's reaction from what he didn't do and what he did do. Moment of crisis. Everybody is afraid they're losing their life. What didn't Jonah do that the mariners did? He did not pray. Now, the sad thing here is the mariners were praying to false gods. There's only one man on the ship that knows the one true and living God. There's only one man on the ship that knows really how to pray. There's only one man on the ship whose prayers actually go anywhere and are heard by anyone. There's only one man on the ship that has the answer to their problems. And he doesn't pray. Why doesn't Jonah pray? He could die here too, you know. Why doesn't Jonah pray? Because Jonah's still trying to get away from the presence of the Lord. If he prayed, he'd be inviting the presence of the Lord onto the ship with him. That's the last thing he wants. The men would rather give up their cargo than die. Jonah would rather die than be in the presence of the Lord. It's a really amazing description in its absence in the story that Jonah does not pray. So, I should say it this way. He doesn't pray yet. He will pray before this adventure is over. But we'll save his prayer for chapter 2. So Jonah, instead of praying, does this. He does something very practical. We would expect, okay, if you're not going to pray, maybe he'll pitch in and help them throw the cargo overboard. Maybe he'll work and help them to survive this crisis. Instead, what Jonah does is, Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship that's below decks and had lain down and was fast asleep. He went into a deep sleep. Now, how do you sleep in a storm that's literally tearing the ship apart? Well, probably he's tired out from his fleeing. You know, he's been running from the Lord since he left Galilee and ran all the way down to Joppa, ran down onto the dock, ran onto the ship, and I think he's exhausted by this point. That's a practical explanation. But spiritually speaking, I think there's something else going on here. Jonah's still trying to escape. He's trying to escape the circumstance in which he finds himself. And sometimes the only escape is, I'm just going to go to sleep and try to forget the world around me. And that's what he does. He goes to sleep, takes a nap, says, you know, I'll deal with this stuff when I wake up, but for now I just don't want to deal with it. So he goes fast asleep. Now, he's interrupted again. This time not by the Lord's hand directly, but the Lord's hand indirectly. I believe the Lord stimulated the captain. I mean, think of this from the captain's perspective. The captain of the ship is in charge of the whole ship. He's responsible for the whole ship. It's a crisis. They're in a huge storm. The ship's breaking apart. They could all lose their lives. And the captain wants to go down and have a conversation with Jonah. Why would he do that? I believe the Lord stirred the heart of the captain to go down and interrupt Jonah's nap. You want to take a nap? No, you're not taking a nap. We're having a conversation. So the captain goes down in verse 6 and wakes him up out of his nap. And he wakes him up not in a good mood. I'm talking about the captain. He's upset. He's angry with Jonah. He's confrontational. He gets right up in Jonah's face and he says, "What do you mean, you sleeper?" Now, this is a description of essentially what the captain is doing. What do you think you're doing? How dare you take a nap? We're all dying here and you're sleeping. And he calls him, "you sleeper," not as a compliment. It's essentially an insult to say you've lost track of what's going on around you. You've checked out. You can't check out. We need all hands on deck. We need everybody to be focused. We need everybody to be working together to try and survive this circumstance. And then he exhorts him. And that's an amazing exhortation, because now, even though Jonah is a prophet who's been called to do what by the Lord? To be a missionary, to represent the Lord to people that don't know the Lord, to go to Nineveh, to speak to unbelievers about the Lord. Now, what happens in Jonah's trying to run away from his assignment? The Lord has an unbeliever speak to Jonah about the right thing to do spiritually in this crisis. This is what we call irony. Irony is an unexpected twist in the story. Jonah should be speaking to these men in the crisis, but he only cares about himself and his attempt to escape the presence of the Lord. And so the Lord raises up an unbeliever, the captain in this case, and the captain exhorts Jonah to do what he's failing to do, which is what? Pray. The captain says, "Arise, call out to your God." He's telling Jonah, don't be sleeping, start praying. Now, he doesn't know, the captain doesn't know, that Jonah's God is the only one true living God. The captain doesn't understand that yet. The captain's from this perspective. He's in charge of an international crew. All these men worship different gods. And he's thinking, I don't know whose God is the real God, but maybe one of these gods will hear one of these men's prayers and save us in this circumstance. In essence, he's saying, we need all the gods we can find in this situation. Don't leave out your God, Jonah. Maybe your God will hear when these other men's God don't hear. But Jonah's God is the one and only true and living God. And Jonah is the one who needs to pray in this circumstance, because it's Jonah's God that has caused the storm. It's Jonah's God that is threatening not just Jonah's life, but the lives of all these men. Think about this, too. It's so important for the Lord to interrupt Jonah that the Lord also interrupted the voyage of all these men. He's willing to go to that extent to get his purpose accomplished. These men didn't ask the Lord, hey, Lord, would you bring a storm upon us? God didn't ask the ship's permission and the captain's permission to cause such a severe storm that they would lose their cargo and lose their wages. That is so important that Jonah's heart would respond and wake up, because that's what's going on here. Jonah's called a sleeper by the captain, and it's a biblical term, even though the captain doesn't understand the meaning of what he's just said to Jonah. Let me give you a couple of New Testament passages on sleeping in the sense of what Jonah was really doing. He is taking a physical nap, but more than that, he's taking a spiritual nap. These two passages, first in Ephesians chapter 5. It uses the image, this passage, of sleeping to describe falling asleep to the right ways of the Lord, and that when we sin, it's kind of like being spiritually asleep, like dreaming. In chapter 5 of Ephesians, verse 14, For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore, it says, we're talking about Scripture, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making use of the time, the best use of the time, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Awake, O sleeper. Jonah was asleep, not just physically asleep, he was spiritually asleep in his rebellion to the Lord. Another passage also in the New Testament, Romans chapter 13. There's other passages that use this same imagery of sleeping to describe this principle, but I'm just going to give you these two as an example. Romans 13, verses 11 and 12. Besides this, you know the time, but the hour has come for you to wake from sleep. For salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed. The night is far gone, the day is at hand, so let us cast off the works of darkness, that's the things that we do when we're spiritually asleep, and put on the armor of light. Alright, so heading back to Jonah, the captain confronts Jonah. The captain urges him to call out to his God, and the thought behind it is perhaps one of these men's gods will give a thought to us. Perhaps your God, Jonah, will think about us when you pray and will survive this circumstance. Verse 7. And then they said to one another. Now this is a conversation involving the captain and his entire crew. They're like strategizing. How can we survive this? And they draw a conclusion, and their conclusion is, this storm has to be a spiritual event, not just a physical event. Somebody is being targeted by their God for punishment. We need to find out who here on the ship is the cause of all this trouble that we're experiencing in this storm. So they said to one another in verse 7, come, let us cast lots, that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. The evil they're referring to is the storm. Let us cast lots. So we don't cast lots anymore, but probably the closest thing in our culture is what we call drawing straws. Have you ever drawn straws before? The idea is it's an apparently random set of circumstances that will determine who is chosen in that picking of random things. And in this circumstance, they're going to all cast lots on the deck of the ship. And they're going to determine whoever the lot falls on, they'll know in their conclusion that it's that person's God that's angry with that person, and they're the cause of all of this storm that's breaking up the ship and causing us to be at risk for losing our lives. So they cast lots, and amazingly, the lot fell where? It fell on Jonah. Now there's two conclusions we can draw from this. One is correct and one is incorrect. It could be just pure coincidence that the lot fell on Jonah, meaning it has no real meaning, there's no real significance. It just accidentally fell on Jonah. Random chance, as they call it. Or it could be that the lot fell on Jonah because the Lord himself was sovereignly in charge of how the lot was cast. And he custom designed this casting of lots to expose Jonah as the cause of this circumstance in the perspective of the mariners on the ship. And that's the correct perspective in this circumstance. This is not accidental. This was not coincidental. This was sovereign. This was purposeful. The Lord caused the lot to fall on Jonah, which identified him as the cause. Now, The Bible addresses this pattern of casting of lots in different places. I'm just going to give you a couple of passages. One is an example, and the other is an instruction teaching us about the casting of lots. The first one is from the book of Joshua. You won't turn there, but I want to give it to you for your notes. Chapter 18, verses 8 through 10. This is a situation, I'll briefly describe it, in which Joshua, who is the leader of God's people, he took over from Moses. The Lord ordained for Joshua to lead the children of Israel across the river Jordan and into the promised land, and he led them in the conquest of the promised land. And when they completed the conquest of the promised land, they then had a responsibility to divide up the promised land into 12 sections, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel to settle. And as they were looking at the promised land, they divided the land into 12 sections, but then they had to figure out which tribe gets which section. And it would be unfair to just say, this tribe gets the best section, because the other tribes would want the best section, wouldn't they? And so what the Lord provided for them was a casting of lots, in which they put the name of each section and each tribe on the lot, so that when they said, okay, we're going to look at lot number one, they would cast 12 lots, one lot for each of the tribes, and whichever name came up, that lot was assigned to that tribe, that parcel of land, that territory was assigned to that tribe. We see from that the Lord was actually in the casting of the lots. He ordained that as a just way for his sovereign intention and plan to be revealed as to which tribe would get which territory. Now, the second portion I said gives us some understanding about the casting of lots. This is from the book of Proverbs, and I will turn to this one. It's Proverbs 16, verse 3, and it says, Proverbs 16, verse 33. It says, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. That means that when people in those days cast lots, the idea was that the lots would come up in a random way. But Solomon here, by the Spirit of God, instructs us and tells us that there are no random events in God's world. God is so sovereign and so in charge of every detail of our lives that even the casting of lots, he's in control of that. He's in charge of that. And he causes the lot to fall in a way that represents his will and purpose for our lives. So, the mariners cast lots that day on the ship, wanting to know who was the cause of all this, and the Lord sovereignly caused the lot to fall on Jonah, exposing Jonah as the true cause of all of this circumstance. As soon as the lot fell on him, verse 8 shows that the mariners, in a sense speaking with one voice, they start hitting him with questions, probing questions. They want to know the story. Tell us your story. Why is this happening? And they ask him five probing questions. And five questions are, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. Meaning, tell us who you are. Number two, what is your occupation? So what was his occupation? Prophet of God. You don't just casually say that. But they're asking him. He's going to tell them the truth. I'm a prophet of God, the one true and living God. And they're going to suddenly realize, we've got a prophet of God, and there must be a reason why a storm is coming on a prophet of God. And then they ask him, where do you come from? They want to know here his hometown. And what is your country? And he's going to tell them, I'm from the holy nation of God's chosen people. I'm from the people of Israel. And they ask him, and of what people are you? And of course, This is where he answers and says to them in verse 9, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. Now, when he says the God who made the sea and the dry land, this is a Hebrew way of describing that God made everything. There's nothing that is in existence that he did not make. So, what's going on here is, after they probe him with these questions, is that Jonah preaches to them. He gives his testimony, and he proclaims the truth of the one true and living God. And they are unbelieving Gentiles. And so the very thing that Jonah ran as far and as fast as he could run from having to do, proclaim the truth to Gentiles, to Gentile unbelievers, God custom designs a new congregation for him to speak to. A second congregation of unbelieving Gentiles. And he is preaching this day. There's not a formal pulpit that he's speaking from, but he is declaring the truth. And he's declaring what is really the core principle of his life, which is that he is a man who fears God, and he identifies him as the God who made everything, the one true and living God. Now, it goes on to say, now in verse 10, then the men were exceedingly afraid. All right, the description here in verse 10 is from earlier in the story, when we look with me back in verse 5. After the storm hit the boat, the mariners were afraid. They were afraid of what? They were afraid of losing their lives in the storm. Now in verse 10, when Jonah proclaims the truth of the Lord to them, then the men were exceedingly afraid. This is the same word for being afraid, but it's multiplied being afraid. So they were afraid of losing their lives in the storm, but now they're even more afraid. Let me ask you this question. How can you be more afraid than afraid of losing your life? Because that's what these men were. These men were more afraid than afraid of losing their life in the storm. There's only one fear that's greater than the fear of losing your life. The book of Hebrews teaches us that every single person that's ever lived in world history, with the exception, of course, of the Lord Jesus, every single person, because they've sinned at least once in their lives, is afraid of one thing above all other things in this life, and that's they're afraid of dying. Because they know down deep in their heart, even if they don't understand it fully, they know down deep in their heart they'll have to stand before the God who made them and the God who requires righteousness of them, and they'll have to give an account for their sin, and they'll have to pay the price for their sin. So there's one fear greater than the fear of losing your life. That's the fear of standing before the God who made them and giving an account to him on the day of judgment. So now that they've heard the truth of the true and living God for the first time, it's the first time in these men's lives they've ever heard the truth. The real truth of God. Now they're really afraid. And in being really afraid, it's not that Jonah has blown it in this opportunity to share the truth with them. Jonah's actually accomplished something wonderful here. It's by the Spirit of God. Obviously, the Lord forced him to proclaim the truth to these men. But for the first time in their lives, these men have experienced the fear of the Lord. The book of Proverbs later tells us in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of true knowledge. These men were living their entire life in ignorance, spiritually, up until this moment. And this crisis was the best thing that ever happened to them. Because the crisis forced Jonah to proclaim the truth. And hearing the truth for the first time, their hearts were faced with their ultimate accountability to the Lord who had made them. All right, we will stop there. And Lord willing, we will pick up our study next week in verse 11, and we will finish chapter 1. Let me stop the recording, and then I'll take whatever questions you might have.